Okay, questions from last time. You sure? Yes.
I have questions that are not about last time.
That are not?
Related to last time.
All right, well then they're questions.
Yes.
Okay, questions.
What about the blockchain role in securing one's data?
I guess that I should be willing to address this in week two instead of in week eight because everybody thinks it's really important. It is sort of important, but it's not important in the way that people think it is. All this cryptocurrency crap, you can just slide over to the other side and forget about it. I know it's a big deal these days. Everybody thinks it's really important, except Nobel Prize winning economists and ministers of finance and central bankers who know that it's a bunch of crap. Blockchain is not entirely a bunch of crap, however, but it's not what you think it is. It's something else. For those who actually want a technical introduction, a nice place to start is with the talk of IBM's Christopher Ferris at our SFLC Columbia Law School conference in 2018. You can find it at softwarefreedom.org. And Chris's talk is a good talk by a technical executive of a complicated company who understands what's going on. And if you really want to learn about blockchain from the ground up, then that will help you. But let me give you the most basic understanding of what this is. You can think of the databases that we used to run enterprise IT in the 20th and early 21st century as collections of tables consisting of rows and columns. That's why the spreadsheet, which is generally speaking a disgusting form of bad software, has turned out to be so important to the way people use information in business. Because the database table can be visualized by a piece of software that just is good at giving you rectangles and helping you to think about rows and columns. But this database structure of tables with rows and columns in it can be everything from all the transactions in Amazon to all the phone calls in Verizon to, right, I mean, you know, all the money in banks. It can all be eventually rendered down and represented as tables, if you like. Those tables then sit inside people's databases in great big digital warehouses consisting of data in these forms. And the people in the world like Oracle and IBM's DB2, people who make software that allows people to build vast quantities of very large tables and to keep all their data in it, were the basic infrastructure software makers for data control in the 20th century. Everybody wound up with warehouses full of that. And they bought a lot of iron from IBM, and they used IBM's DB2, or they bought a lot of hardware from Hewlett-Packard, and they used Oracle. But the basic structure of enterprise information technology revolved around how database tables are stored. And one of the outcomes of that architecture is that everybody's got all their data in their own silo. Because you don't invite foreigners or strangers, let alone competitors, to come into your data center and hook in and remove any of your tables. Database storage of that kind, big IT data management, was very good at helping companies to maintain their own data, whether that was Bank of America, or that was Boeing, or that was the Bank of China. It didn't really matter. Everybody had all the data that was relevant to their operations stuck in some tables, in some database, in their warehouse somewhere. Right? And that is optimal for many purposes. But there are some other kinds of purposes for which that sort of tabular storage in the silo of a business isn't the best way to store data. Let's take, for example, a database of airplanes and parts. Each airline really does want to have a bunch of databases, a bunch of database tables about its airplanes. Each airplane is a row, and each column is all the things that have been done to that airplane and its service history and all the parts that were required for it and everybody who's flown it and so on and so on. And that's nice, but it might actually be a really good idea if every airplane part were accounted for in a database that everybody could read. That would help the regulators, that would help the financial community, that would help to control counterfeit parts, that would help to avoid accidents. It would be really nice, in other words, if there were some public place that you could go and look and find all that data. The problem is that ensuring that any public version of the data is accurate, that it hasn't been messed with, that it hasn't fallen behind, that it isn't out of sync, that things haven't happened to it, is really hard. You would like to be able to have some way that you can have a completely or a different architectural idea about the role of data in the world. You would like to have public, strongly authenticated copyable data. Known to be genuine. Up to date and equally available through at least some users. Using strong encryption technologies of a kind that we now take for granted, which we will be talking about in other contexts in a few weeks, and which it used to be the role of government to prevent people from having, because encryption control was regarded as so important to the Cold War American Empire. But never mind. A few crazy people, of whom I am proud to be one, destroyed that system of regulation and made strong encryption available to the world, and therefore we can now achieve something like this through what we call blockchain. Blockchain's a storage mechanism. It allows the replacement of databases in individual silos by public ledgers which contain all the same data but which are cryptographically ensured to be accurate. In order to add a block to the chain, you not only have to show who you are, but you have to encrypt in such a way that a digital signature means that everybody knows you changed it, and when you changed it, and why you changed it. And under those circumstances, any copy of that ledger will be fine, because it will automatically disclose whether it has been modified and what last was added to the blockchain, and everybody will be able, in effect, to keep much of the information which is in their database silos instead out there in public storage in the world. And in a world in which storage is cheap and networking is ever-present and it's easy to move large quantities of data around anytime you want to look at them, and the technologies that underlie the databases have become a little bit obsolete for a variety of other reasons we could talk about, blockchain is a really effective alternative for some purposes. The cryptocurrency purpose is not the most important purpose, but it's the one everybody thinks is very sexy and everybody concentrates on. So they think that this has something to do with money. It doesn't have to do with money. It has to do with software and something. In the end, public or semi-public ledgers, where the data circulates among a closed club of people, call them a stock exchange, call them central banks, call them whatever you want, the form in which software can be made so that instead of being stored in private copies located within the power and perimeter of particular businesses, can instead be shared widely, processed widely, and yet understood at any given moment to be genuine and to be verifiable, that's a really powerful form of software. 15 or 20 years from now, blockchain devices for data storage and management will be as ever-present and as fundamental to the economy of large-scale enterprises that use IT as databases, the so-called relational databases I'm describing over there, now are. And enterprise software will have shifted architectures towards much more reliance on public cryptographically signed and secured data. That will have changed money, but it won't have changed money into Bitcoin. It will have changed the way that central banks understand the transactions in the economies around them. Instead of the complex, highly insecure, and really quite retrograde SWIFT system that moves money around between banks in the world, and which a couple of clever criminals used to steal $3 billion from the National Bank of Bangladesh, most of which wound up in Macau, which is an excellent place for taking dirty money, that the system of interbank clearances in the world, for example, will have moved to blockchain, which is exactly the sort of thing that should happen. But in order to understand what's going on, you have to think much more about the design and function of software than the design and function of money. It so happens that cryptocurrency was the first important user of these data designs. In the same way that porn is often the first user of new network capabilities for communication. But that doesn't mean that the web is about porn, and it doesn't mean that blockchain is about cryptocurrency. Is that a responsive answer? There will be lots of time to follow this up, because we will be out there spearing hype and reducing belief in revolution all through this course, while I am actually trying to say, no, not that revolution, that's a bunch of crap. Look at this revolution over here. This one is real. Okay? That will be part of my task. But with respect to blockchain, that's the quick summary. Any follow-ups? Additional questions about this? Questions about something else? Yeah. Don't bother, because it isn't working, and I'm not going to let anybody have the bits you make by talking into it. Okay. Go ahead.
I also heard about the quantum computer. We know that, we have said that the blockchain is kind of the safest way to store the data today, but I also heard from some news that the quantum computer, you know, is the kind of computer which has more and more computational power.
Maybe.
You can somehow
maybe. It would be nice. It would be nice to be able to harness the peculiarity that Albert Einstein said was there but didn't want to believe. That in the way that the universe is actually constructed, it is possible for two particles that once upon a time originated in the same place, more or less, and in the same universe, to be very far apart and moving on arbitrary trajectories and yet to have an odd relationship to one another. So if one, something happens to one particle, it will automatically happen to the other particle wherever it is. Einstein referred to this as spooky action at a distance. And it was one of the things that made him disbelieve in the whole probabilistic form of physics that he was helping to bring into existence. Like many mathematicians and physicists, but mathematicians particularly, Einstein was at his best when he was young. Now, between 1905 and 1920, when he won the Nobel Prize for the earliest of the work he did, not the best of the work he did, he wound up destroying an awful lot of the physics that he believed in, or at least setting it up for destruction. And then a bunch of other people, like Heisenberg, came along, and they finished the work of destroying the Newtonian physics in which he believed and replaced it with this quantum mechanical understanding of the universe, which turned out to be really necessary because the theory of relativity produced a whole lot of stuff that you couldn't really account for very well in Newtonian physics. That's why he invented it. But he didn't like the consequences of that. And one of the consequences of the form of thinking about the world that his effort created involve the kinds of phenomena, both at tiny scale in the world and maybe also at much larger scale, that make the universe difficult to understand with one set of equations, no unified field theory, right? It would be nice to be able to use spooky action at a distance to do computing. It would be nice to have computers in which circuitry didn't have to either be on or off, and in which binary calculation wasn't embedded in the physics of the devices. And it would be really nice to be able to take two particles or two messages separated by a very long distance and to make it impossible to see one without affecting the other, which would produce some really interesting encryption. Along the way, it would also make it possible to build computers which don't have the same limitations on computing. This isn't only about faster. This is about the question of whether certain problems are really, 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 really hard or they're not. Right? We have a theory in the practice of computing which says that certain problems do not resolve in polynomial time. As you make the problem space larger, there's no relationship that you can describe in a simple algebraic way between the size of the problem and how long it takes you to solve that problem. That's known as an NP complete problem. It requires non-polynomial time to characterize how long it takes to solve the problem. I'll give you an example, which is the old basic example of this. It's called the traveling salesman. The question is, you have a traveling salesperson who goes on a route to make trips to sell things to people. Design the shortest possible route that the salesperson can travel that doesn't involve visiting any one place twice and it gets to all the places in the shortest possible journey. Euler worked this out with the nine bridges of Königsberg in the 19th century. But the traveling salesman problem is a hard problem, NP complete. Another similar problem, if you grew up in the world of cassette tapes, which of course you didn't, is you have a certain number of records and you have a certain number of blank tapes of various lengths, 60 minutes, 90 minutes. How do you fit the most music on the fewest tapes? That's another problem. That's called a knapsack. We have a nice theorem, which may be correct, but which has never had been proven, that all NP-complete problems are actually the same. You can see how this traveling salesman problem and this cassette tapes problem could be turned into one another, maybe. We have a theorem that says all such problems can be turned into one another. They're all the same problem. Maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong. For the purpose of the things we're interested in now, the effect of computers on society, the most important thing is that factoring large numbers is a hard problem. Taking an arbitrary number 100 digits long and figuring out what its factors are, it takes a lot of time. And the larger you make the number, the more time it takes. And we don't believe there's any way to linearize that time so that as the length of that number grows, the problem of factoring it doesn't grow as n squared. It's not an NP-complete problem, it's a polynomial time problem. The problem is it's an n-squared problem. The larger you make the number, the time it takes to deal with it, factor it into its factors, grows as the square of the number, not as the number itself. This is important because all the digital encryption technologies that we're going to be talking about are based on the problem of factoring large numbers. I'll explain more in detail why when we get there. But for the moment, just accept that. The problem of factoring large numbers is why digital encryption works, why it's hard to break digital encryption structures. Quantum computing, if you had good quantum computers, and we can define in a mathematically precise way how good those quantum computers have to be. If you have quantum computers that can manipulate more than 64 qubits, never mind what for the moment the qubit is, just you need about that much. Then you begin to approach the point in which you might actually be able to factor large numbers in linear time because of the magic of quantum computing. In which case, you could fuck up all the world's encryption very bad and become the most powerful entity there is. Accordingly, the governments which are capable of building such machines, and there are only three governments on Earth that are capable of building such machines, need to be in a race with one another to see that, make sure that the other guy doesn't get to it and destroy all the digital security and all your financial system and everything else all at once. All this quantum computing stuff, in other words, is a conversation about nuclear weapons in the world of computing. Someday, yes, indeed. Someday. And therefore, quantum computing, like blockchain, and like the other one, which of course everybody understands is going to have to do like this, in, at least in my classroom, artificial intelligence. These are all names of really powerful and important things that are not what people think they are, and they're not what we have right now, but they're really interesting and important, and they can make a lot of difference. And if we could just learn to understand the world in which we currently live, then we could have some really interesting conversations about these other things. But in order to do that, we're going to have to wring the hype out of the washing very hard. And I actually didn't plan to be talking about either blockchain or quantum computing here. In fact, I didn't plan to talk about any of these things here today. But the most important hype I'm going to be whacking away at this semester is the idea of artificial intelligence. There is such a thing. I mean, artificial general intelligence can occur. But I've been doing this work in one or another technical way since I was 14 years old, and I'm really, really old now. And people I liked and respected have been telling me about artificial intelligence around the corner since I was a teenager, and I don't believe them now for the same reasons that I didn't believe them then. It's not the problem people think it is. It's a different problem, and it's really, really hard. And the reason that they can't do it very well is they don't understand human beings. They understand computers just fine. But the idea of artificial intelligence means artificially creating something that is human intelligence or general intelligence, and they don't understand what that is. And so they get it wrong, and then we have problems. We'll talk a lot about so-called artificial intelligence at present, which is pattern recognition by machines. Useful stuff, no question about it, okay? But not artificial intelligence. It's like self-driving cars. Yeah, right, okay. I mean, yes, you can do it, but don't try and do it in Boston on a snowy day. That's not what this talks about. What this is wrong. It's good. It's terrific. Great models are better than bad models. But no model is actually what happens when a human being flies an airplane. The inertial guidance systems of large airplanes are absolutely wonderful. And there's really good software for taking off and landing, which is hard. And you could get into a 747, or at least a modified one, and press a button, and fly from here to Paris, and everything is fine. Until something goes wrong. At which point, it isn't fine anymore, and you need pilots. And no matter what you say about that, you're still going to need them when something goes wrong. Elon Musk just proved a wonderful thing, which is that you can totally automate blasting off and going to orbit and coming home and coming through the Earth's atmosphere and splashing down, and nobody has to do anything manual at all until something goes wrong. And despite the fact that he's in promotion mode at the moment, Musk would be the first to agree that someday somebody's got a whole bunch of people going to die. Because something's going to go wrong. And the machine will not be able to compensate for what goes wrong. That's the definition of what goes wrong. In the course of driving cars or flying airplanes, there is a bunch of stuff which you need, not just with pattern recognition or excellent automation. You actually need to understand how human beings respond when things go wrong. In order to do that, you need general intelligence. In the same way that we're talking about whether you can use Newtonian physics to understand the world around. So I'm going to spend a fair amount of time saying, yeah, AI. As long as you don't think that means intelligence, and as long as you put the emphasis on artificial, we can discuss it. But the minute you begin to get into believing that the software we can make now can do all the things that people are claiming for it, you will get roped. You will be scammed. Things will not be what you think they are, and you will have spent a ton of money on them. And there is an awful lot of liar's poker going on in the world around technology at the moment. All of which would make an interesting course, but it's not my course. Because my course is still really interested in human beings' rights, and in the structures that we call freedom, and what it is that these technologies are doing to that. And that, I still would like to believe is even more important than whether blockchain is good for this or that, or whether you can legitimately call a Tesla driving on autopilot that hasn't crashed into something yet artificial intelligence. But all of those subjects are rolled up in the stuff we're talking about. And today what I really want to do is just discuss the internet and what that means. So we're still at a fairly basic level. But that doesn't mean that it isn't useful to at least spend a little time pissing on AI. It's always good to spend a little time pissing on AI. A day without pissing on AI is like a day in which the Liar's Poker players win. More? Yeah.
So you talked about the GDPR last week a little bit. Can you explain why you think it misses the mark? And
yeah, I can. I'll do the one sentence version now, and then in a couple of weeks I'll do way more. The problem with GDPR is that it takes consent as the way to conduct privacy. And it isn't, because privacy is not a transactional problem in which you give me your information and I give you a gumball and you feel happy and I feel happy, and in some weird microeconomic way we have achieved Pareto superiority, like a gains in trade. GDPR, at the end of the day, still believes that myth. It's not true. Privacy is an ecological. And ecological problems can't be solved by consent-based regulation. I can't give everybody in the society clean water by saying, how much will you pay to take dirty water and give it to your children? How much do I have to pay to take dirty water and give it to your children? We have to have uniform societal standards which are uniformly applied and cannot be varied by consent. The problem with GDPR is that it wants to live in a world in which individual consent-based decision-making will magically yield overall optimal privacy outcomes, and it won't. You can't do air pollution that way, you can't do water pollution that way, and you can't do privacy pollution that way. So GDPR is an attempt to do everything right on the basis of a foundation which won't allow it, and you have to go in some different direction. Which, after all, the commission knew by the time it was halfway through. That's the short answer, okay? Save the remainder of the questions until we have time to deploy the long answer. But in order to do that, we have to get the other parts of the world up and running. Because the other problem with GDPR is it's an imperialist structure. It believes that it can export good rules everywhere where a citizen of the European Union is to be found, like in this lawsuit. And if you ask, how good is GDPR compliance at Columbia University, the answer will be it isn't. The idiots who do things around here think that that cookie notice at the bottom of the website is the GDPR compliance. In fact, I listened to bullshit consultants explaining that to me on the technology committee back before the epidemic began. So GDPR not only says I can get everything that European privacy rights require by consent, but I can then export that everywhere. I can get everybody to adopt those standards, and then everybody will give consent for every use, and those shithead American opt-out persons will have to replace it with opt-in, and yeah, give me a break. In the world in which we actually live, that's not the dispute. In the world where we actually live, the dispute is, who's going to wind up with the hand on the top of the pole? The people who prefer to ignore the fact that they're committed to human rights of privacy they're not enforcing? Or the people who deny altogether that there are such rights? That's the position of the two leading economies on Earth. The European Commission is standing in there with no Google, no Alibaba, no fucking nothing, saying, but we will fix all that by exportable regulation about consent. And we will bully the Americans into going our way by denying Privacy Shield, and then all the data they want to collect about Europeans' behavior, they won't be able to transfer to North America, and they will come to the table and work this out. Meantime, over in Beijing, a bunch of people are saying, you guys can yammer on all you want, but we don't intend to acknowledge any of those rights, ever. So screw you. And then we all have a lot of conversation about whether China policy is good or bad in the European Commission or the United States. Now, notice that we're not engaging the real question, which is, do people have rights, and are we going to protect them? That, for me, is the subject here, which is why GDPR is not the subject. Is that sufficient for the day?
Thank you.
Okay. Yes?
I have another GDPR-related question.
Okay.
You mentioned that we should have an environmental standard when it comes to regulating data. That's better.
Yeah, actually, what I would say about that is we need environmental standards to regulate the collection of human behavior.
Yeah, collection of human behavior. But you just mentioned that the issue with China and the collection of data on the GDPR, and that's not workable. So how would you merge those things together? How would you
regulate? That's a really good question. I suppose there are two sides to me about that. One of those sides is the need that things that if I could get the right bunch of people together, I would like to go and discuss how to have visual freedom with Chinese characteristics with the party. Right? That is to say, to actually conduct that conversation as though the goal were to get to an understanding in which each of the two greatest of the world societies could achieve what it wants, recognizing what are the minimum characteristics that would have to be undertaken in order to make that possible given their political needs. With respect to free and open source software, a subject that we do know a lot about, which we didn't talk about in here, that's a really possible conversation with the party. The party needs Fox. It needs all that software being made all over the world that it can use to increase the prosperity and efficiency of Chinese society. What it doesn't want is the freedom in which we make that software. And I have, over the course of the last couple of years, had various conversations with CSIP, the Chinese state internet regulator, to discuss what it would mean to convene such a conversation. The other part of me doesn't want to have that conversation. The other part of me wants to say, look, you're 1.4 billion people and you have a right to govern yourselves. If you want to create perfect digital autocracy, if you want to deprive people in China of all the things we think are important in that context, because the Chinese people don't think those are important, they think something else is important, fine, okay. Unfortunately, we're going to need to have a wall. And the question is, where is that wall going to go? I'll tell you that it's not in the Pearl River Delta between Shenzhen and Hong Kong. That's no longer feasible. From the point of view of the Chinese Communist Party, that wall cannot be in the South China Sea with Taiwan on the other side of it. That's not acceptable either. The consequence is the Australians are driving a bunch of nuclear submarines around that they neither know how to make nor know how to service, but they need nuclear submarines because they need to put up a wall in the South China Sea that isn't there. That's not a good solution, but on the other hand, I believe in freedom and I want to be allowed to talk about it. I don't want to have to talk about freedom with Chinese characteristics because I'm not a Chinese person and that's not my job. So I have two feelings. I don't know that I can achieve either one of those two. I'm not saying I could fix the world if only I could decide which way. I can't. But I can't even make my own thinking coherent on this question. What I can do is to write to the future, 75 years from now, and say, you know how this all came out. I don't know how it all came out, but 75 years from now, everybody on Earth will know how it came out. I hope you still have freedom. Am I speaking a language that you in the future can understand? That I can do in the remaining weeks of my life. This other thing, I'm not so sure. Is that responsible?
Unlocking. I understand that the good thing about distributed ledger technology is that it's publicly authenticated, it's updated in real time. However, how do we reconcile that with its own privacy implications? Because for example, for cryptocurrency, if you have someone's address, you can basically follow the money. You can find out what the transactions are.
Yeah, that's why owners talk about cryptocurrencies. It's not a good introduction to the system. The purposes that blockchain best serves are situations in which data can become more accountable, not less accountable. Yeah, you can make quasi-anonymity out of encryption devices, including by blockchain. But I can show you that we had good anonymous digital currency that didn't involve blockchain in the early 1990s, as I said last time. It was defeated by encryption controls. It wasn't defeated by the absence of blockchain. I am the only person in this room who actually knows who Satoshi Nakamoto was. I know what happened. I understand how all of that came into existence. Among people who were part of our movement and who were my comrades doing the effort of trying to destroy encryption controls by the United States in the early 1990s. It was an interesting proof of concept about something. And Bitcoin in particular, if you look at it, is a proof of concept. Anything which totally limits the amount of currency of any kind in the world to a mathematical limit is a toy. All gold that we ever acquired in the course of the entire European effort to pillage the world of gold, which is what it was, and lasted for roughly 500,000 years, all that pillaging generated a cube of gold about 50 feet on its side. That's all there was. But we never thought that was all there was ever going to be, right? Gold was useful because you could still get more of it. Bitcoin isn't. Now, among my client base in the Software Freedom Law Center are Ethereum and Monero, two of the commonest and most widely used alternatives to Bitcoin generated in the period when cryptocurrency development was not merely a matter of hype, but was actually technological achievement. And there are uses for the forms of cryptocurrency that aren't quite as limited as Bitcoin, and that whose definition of proof of work doesn't involve using as much electricity as a middle-sized country, okay? I mean, the problem with Bitcoin is it's a proof of concept about what you could do if you didn't actually care about how much time and effort and energy it took to generate a tinfoil ingot, okay? But we do. And there's no way that we move to a transactional form in the world in which the total amount of all the money that can exist is stringently limited, and you have to use more and more and more and more and more electricity to find it at any given moment. That's not the way it's going to work. But Bitcoin was a wonderful experiment and conducted beautifully by the person called Satoshi Nakamoto. And we're still interested in it, but we shouldn't be as interested in it as we are, because it's not a good model of what it is that we're trying to do, right? So let's just say that there is some gap between fantasy and reality in all of this. With respect to the, we're going to have anonymous digital currency and it's Bitcoin, that's fantasy purely. With respect to we could have anonymous digital payment systems that would be as good at protecting ourselves as cash is, against the scrutiny of others? Yes, indeed we could, but we're never going to have them. Not because they're technically impossible, but because there is no government on earth that wants them to exist. Nobody wants their tax systems destroyed. Nobody wants their control over their monetary supply destroyed. Chinese Communist Party was okay with Bitcoin for a while, as they were okay with Evergrande. But what's going on at the moment is the Chinese Communist Party deciding to get real and run an economy that doesn't contain bubbles that they can't control. For a while, they thought it was a pretty good way of beating a stick on state banks and in enterprises which had deeply corrupted the Chinese economy. Now they don't think so. It's a good way of modeling certain kinds of questions, but it's not actually a way of operating. Does that respond? You want to follow up? Anything else that we should talk about before we start trying to talk about the internet? All right. So, here's the difficulty. Lawyers in particular are very territorial thinkers. In this respect, they're like military. They like to think in terms of space. Each of the activities, military and law, involve delimited territorial structures, a battlefield somewhere, a hill to take, a strategic set of rules, where I govern, inside my borders. Therefore, lawyers, like military people, tended at the beginning of the digitalization of society to talk in terms of cyberspace, a place. This is a uniform, well, not uniform, not unanimous, but a commonplace way of thinking at the end of the 20th century. My dear comrade, now deceased, John Perry Barlow, created this unit called the Declaration of Independence for Cyberspace. John Perry was extremely good with pipes. That's what made him an excellent Grateful Dead songwriter. Mexicali Blues, an excellent pipe. Declaration of Independence, Cyberspace, an excellent pipe. I had to install a pipe for a minute because we were sitting at lunch at the first Future of Music conference in Washington, D.C. in the year 2000, and John Perry and Chuck D and I and a couple of other people, journalists, were sitting at lunch, and I said something, and John Perry turned to me and said, I've always wanted to write the .com in this manifesto. That's a good idea. That's a real good idea. So I stole it. And I was slow, as I usually am, and my father was dying, and various other stuff. So it took me 2.5 years, and in 2003, I had the .com in his manifesto, and I sent it to John Perry. I said, you thought this up, you signed with me. But he wasn't interested. He thought I'd do other things, so I took it. I took it from Marx and Engels, but in the end. So cyberspace, as an idea, Al Gore thought it, John Perry thought it, the military thought it, lots of people thought it. Let's begin, now that it's unpopular and people don't tend to use it anymore for the reasons that I argued about in the Invisible Barbecue in 97, people don't mostly spatialize the net anymore. But the military and the military planners and the public policy guys, they still talk about cyber war and cyberspace, And lawyers still do it because they need a jurisdiction, It's like lex loci server and stuff like that. So there's a tendency, now increasingly obsolete, to think about the net as a space. This is a really, really bad idea. You never heard a lawyer talk about telephone space when two people get on a telephone and they make a contract. Nobody thinks the contract was made in telephone space. Yes, your contracts teacher taught you a mailbox rule, but that didn't mean the contract was made in the mailbox, right? There's a dispute. Was it made here, or was it made there, or was it made someplace that people agreed that it was made, even though that wasn't true? Lawyers are into space, but telephone space we never had, and cyberspace we never had either. But for a while, we used that idea. The next problem that arises is a more fundamental human problem, not just the problem of lawyers and soldiers. Reification, the tendency to make ideas into things. So the internet as a thing is the second myth that we need to bend our minds to get around. You can see it in the Brian Chen piece on the privacy war, the privacy battle changing the internet piece that I put on the radar this week. The description is of a fight between Google and Apple, which is important and which we need to think about and understand, in which both Facebook and the other ad targeters of the world are threatening to be collateral damage, no matter which of the two big boys wins the fight. But to say that that's changing the internet is a reification. It's not. It's changing the practices of some businesses. And the minute you begin to talk about it as though it were redefining the internet, you're back to a reification structure which is going to lead your analysis astray quite soon. If the net is not a space, and if it's not a thing, what is it? How should we understand this word internet that we use? We can understand it historically and technically, but that's not what I'm talking about. I mean, what is the conceptual framework that we should use when we approach this stuff for which the grunt, internet, is used? The answer is that the net is not a space and it's not a thing. It's the name of a new social condition, a new way for society to organize itself. The internet is the name of the condition in which every human being is actually or potentially connected to every other human being everywhere all the time. without other human intermediaries. We entered that social condition at the end of the 20th century. We are less than 12,000 days into that structure. In the last 5,000 days, less than the last 5,000 days, the last decade, that structure took upon itself what we have now come to call social media. That's a meaningless phrase. Social media, yeah, I mean, right. But what we're talking about is a particular structure of the form of everybody's connected to everybody actually or potentially. A form of it. Not the only form of it, not the inevitable form of it, a form of it. So, that's the first thing that we can do to grasp the net. We can understand that we're not talking about a place, we're not talking about a thing, we're talking about a sociological condition, a morphology of human society. Or, as I have described it to you metaphorically here over the last 2 weeks, as a new extraskeletal nervous system embracing the human species as a superorganism. Ants in an anthill could have the same conversation, okay? Using the word anthill for the word internet. What is this anthill about? Is it a place? Is it a thing? No, it's the outcome of being ants. This is our sociality. And no doubt it evolved in the sense that ants have been around a long time. It's 600 million years ago. And even though once upon a time they were in the Burgess Shale as things that were crawling in the bottom of the sea, by the time they came onto land and began to do the work that ants do, which is pretty much all the work that can be done by living things, farming, slaving, everything. And they were doing it in a superorganism in which each ant is connected by a variety of complexities that we still don't really understand at all. And the organism is the hill. Not the individual ant. We are becoming like that as a human species. The moment at which that really began wasn't radio, it wasn't the telephone, it wasn't the Edisonian invention. The moment when we really started to become like that was at the beginning of your lifetime. And your lifetime is special in the whole multi-million year history of the human being because it is within your lifetime that that process is going to be completed. And human race will be different at the other end of your lifetime and your children's lifetime than it was when mine began in the middle of the 20th century. The difference is the sociological alteration in the nature of human sociality, which we could call the internet. Yeah?
Working with this anthill analogy, an anthill kind of developed for the ant species to protect itself in this, I guess, Darwinian way.
Some ant species. There are a lot of them. We don't even know how many they are, and not all of them make hills. But you're correct. Natural selection formed the superorganism we call the anthill. And?
So does it follow that the internet is like, there's like this Darwinian explanation for the internet? And that
no, because there's a Lamarckian explanation for the internet. Because human cultural evolution occurs in a Lamarckian fashion through the acquisition of acquired characteristics. That's why human beings work the way they work, why human cultural evolution occurs at the speed of light compared to natural selection. A selection process is there, but it isn't Darwinian because it isn't natural selection. It's Lamarckian because it depends upon the ability of human beings to create structures through the descent of acquired characteristics called teaching. The way this is put in the first paragraph of the book, second paragraph of the book I'm working on now, which is directly responsive to what you're asking, is we have become who we are. I mean, the whole human race over millions of years, we have become who we are through our ability to teach one another. The great epochs in human history, the biggest units in the periodization of the life of the human beings, The greatest periodization has to do with how we teach one another. In the long first era of human history, let's say it begins approximately 5 million years ago, and we part company with our chimp cousins and our bonobo cousins, right? The species closest to our own, our family, 98.5% the same genome. And yet, for the last 5 million years, we've been traveling down different worlds. In the first era of that human history, we teach by example. This is how you kill a rock. Teacher to student by immediate demonstration. That process made the human being for the first many million years. Somewhere, it doesn't fossilize well, so we can't dig it out of the ground. Somewhere, about 200,000 years ago, we acquired complex articulate speech. And by we now, I don't just mean Homo sapiens or any one lineage of hominids. We can now be reasonably certain that our near cousins, the people we call Neanderthal, and the people we didn't even know because we hadn't found one finger joint that we called the Denisovans, all these forms of hominids who were different, acquired speech somewhere down there about 200,000 years ago. From the moment that we had complex articulate speech, we began teaching not by example, but by precept. We began explaining things to one another. And that process of changing how we teach one another altered the structure of human beings' sociality firmly. In the first era of the human race, those first several million years, we lived in bands. Small groups of a few dozen individuals across three generations living in the same way together and teaching one another by example. This is how you nap a flint. Complex articulate speech, among other things, made the tribe. The larger collection of human beings, sociologically linked in the same morphology, which is a larger thing than a band, a composite of bands held together by speech. And if we look at the remaining forms of human sociality that we see around us, which are now older versions of human sociology by two epochs, we can see how the tribe was made by the ability to talk. The very end of that last 200,000 years of speaking, about 5,000 years ago, we began to write. Writing again changes the way that human beings are taught, because the value of teaching by precept can now be described over a much larger area and more time. Teaching can occur from person to person through the word, through text. This is what brings about what we call civilization in a rather self-aggrandizing way. But it would also be correct to say that writing created the state out of the tribe. And the state is able to achieve durability over space and time in ways that tribal society could not even have contemplated, let alone arrived at. Those were the three eras of the human race before your lifetime. We are now entering a fourth one. It too begins in a revolutionary alteration in the mode of teaching. Because in all generations following your own, for the first time in the history of human beings, the primary teacher will be the machine, not the human being. The fundamental structure of how we teach one another, the ability to perform in Lamarckian time rather than Darwinian, the ability to hand down acquired characteristics, thus infinitely accelerating the pace of human evolution socially, not biologically. Theodosius Dobzhansky is still correct as he was in the 1940s. Man evolves in natural selection terms, but that's irrelevant to the pace of human evolution overall. It's too slow. When the machine is the primary default teacher of human beings for the first time in the history of the human race, everything else changes. Okay, fine. I'm not here to tell you that we should turn the flow of history backward, but we must learn the fundamental lessons that civilization taught us. And in the last 500 years of those 5,000 years of what we are pleased to call civilization, we learned something new. The thing we call individualism. The thing we call human self-determination. The thing we call democracy. The thing that I and my team call freedom of thought. We had that for only 500,000 years of the 5,000 years at the back of the 5 million years of being human beings. We could lose it now, yes.
Tying this back to one of our earlier classes.
Sorry?
Just tying this conversation back to one of our earlier classes about books. For thousands of years, the way that we passed down knowledge was just from mouth to mouth, you know, person to person.
From mouth to ear.
Fair enough. Yeah, good point. That's fair.
That other way is constantly tried and doesn't actually work.
So then when books came along, most people got all their knowledge from
Well, you need to say that writing doesn't start with books. And then you have to define the social access to writing. So you need to think about structures of divinity and priesthood, and you need to think about Egyptian literacy as opposed to Sumerian literacy, and so on. And that all happens before we ever get to the mass-produced printed book, which is the other end of that process and the beginning of something new, but I'm just trying to keep this stratigraphy right now. I mean, it's only about where the fossils are that you're actually talking. Please go ahead.
I guess I'm thinking about like the use of books and now the internet as just like facilitators for passing knowledge down generation to generation.
Is it really?
Well, I mean, don't you think Wikipedia is now just like a supplement to whatever education you get?
No, I understand when that was invented too. Jimmy Wells was trying to do a thing which my comrade Richard Stallman in the 1979 essay called The Encyclopedia Everybody Can Edit was trying to do. We were trying to kill the textbook publishers. I can remember a conversation with Jimbo. I don't remember exactly when it occurred, but sometime late in the 20th century, in which we were talking about the evolution of Wikipedia. And Jimbo said about whatever stage in the architecture we were talking about, and that's when the textbook publishers' heads exploded. That was the real goal. And we did very nicely. I mean, we destroyed the control of encyclopedia. We created a way for every human being to start performing research, which was free in all senses, and which we collectively produced in anarchy, without ownership. But no, it didn't do the job of making it possible for everybody to learn. It tried to kill the ownership of one of the ways of learning, thus trying to achieve our larger social goal, which was to allow every brain on earth to learn everything it wants, whenever it wants, wherever it is, without regard to ability to pay or the whims of power. But that's a slightly different goal. The net has not actually improved people's access to books as much as I would wish. We should scan everything. And it should be available in free formats. And everywhere you want to read a book, you should be able to read any book you want without being surveilled by anybody while doing it, which is exactly what we don't have. And the devices on which we read should help us read better, stronger, longer, more capaciously, should help us to remember and understand what we are reading. And instead, what we have is fucking Kindle. We have little closed walled gardens of the ownership of the book you read. And if somebody at Amazon decides that that copy of Animal Farm that you bought, or 1984, should no longer exist, they reach in there and take it away from you. What kind of book is that? A book that burns itself. No good. And now, most of you are accustomed to reading on devices which hurt your ability to read. Because it's an infinite scroll. And as I was describing last time, that's not good for your memory, and it's not good for training your ability to read. I understand that nobody's ever going to read War and Peace again, but try reading War and Peace on infinite scroll. On a little thing. Not to mention little questions like what happened to 500,000 years of typographic knowledge. I really like pixel cube displays like the Kindle. The pixel cube display is a wonderful invention. I'll bet you there's not a person in the room who can tell me who invented it. You're all into intellectual property to protect the invent, but you don't know who invented it. That was a person, a female person, moreover, I should say. Mary Lou Jepson. I like the display. It's great. The high contrast, beautiful reading in both bright ambient light and dark light and darkness, an extremely power unhungry form compared to all the display technologies that preceded. It's totally excellent. But it gets used in things like Kindle and the typography. Please don't get me started. 500,000 years ago, Italian people figured out how to make nice typefaces, which is all ignored by the way you read. I'm not surprised it doesn't work well. You're reading Comic Sans or Avant-Garde? Really, really? So I too read on screens all the time. The criteria of acceptability for that technology is one, it must use type the way I want it used. Two, it must use light the way I want it used, which isn't always bright white behind dark black. That's only good under some circumstances. It must be absolutely adaptable to what I want with respect to everything else on the digital displays around it. Size, intrusiveness, degree of excess readability, if you like. That is to say, how much more readable is the book I'm looking at than the terminal window I'm using to do some other job? All of that has to be under my control. And the text has to be under my control. It has to be my copy that I am using by myself, that I can annotate and change and remark any way I want at any time. And I have to be able to give it to anybody I please. And that's all readily achievable. Just don't ask them to give it to you on the platforms. They won't. They don't want you to have that. And if you don't have as good a reading environment as you could have, so what? Big deal. You have an iPhone, don't you? What are you complaining about? Whereas from my point of view, we can document the extent to which you are less good readers than the people who came before you. And that should worry the fuck out of you. Is it really better to do your legal research on a tablet through Westlaw than to sit up there and move around the shelves and grab books and do the things? No, it isn't. That's better. Because it gives a lawyer a different way of thinking about the material she's using and how she's using it. And it gives her an opportunity to use her memory, the strength of her mind for things that will help her mind be strong. She won't grow flaccid. During the time that I worked in the Supreme Court and for a few years afterwards, my recall of the contents of the United States reports was extremely good. I mean, really good. When we were together as clerks used to get freaked out about me because we would be sitting around and talking about some case or other, and I would walk over to the shelf because there's a set of the U.S. reports in every room in the Supreme Court, and I would take the volume off the shelf and open to the page, and then we would go because I knew 580 volumes, roughly speaking, at the time. Thick volumes. And I knew where everything was. If I had been grown up not on the physical books, no way. Absolutely no way. Because those numbers don't mean anything to me. They're just purely arbitrary. Volume X, page Y, they don't really exist. And so you don't bother keeping them. In the same way that you use Google to tell you where things are instead of knowing. The way you read determines not just which reading you have in your head, but how your head works. It's what constitutes what we call the literate mind. And this stuff is fucking with you. I don't want to get close enough to break the rules, but there it is. It's the ring of power, okay? Amen. A brilliant artist and a moral monster. And he had absolutely no love for the human race, of which he was not a part. Oh, you think that's funny? But you didn't know. And he never cared whether it was good for you. He never cared whether it was good for you. He cared whether it was beautiful, which is what artists thought to do. And it's beautiful. But it's there. That's the way in which all this feels to me. You understand that that was not law professor talk. That was a human being talking about the world he lives in. That's how it feels to me to be here. I feel as though I live in the eternal gap, indeed the abyss, between what you could have and what you believe you can have. That's why I say the underlying political premise of the work I do here in this room, in my practice, in my political life, the underlying premise is freedom begins in knowing that another world is possible. What has happened to the way we respond to the ideas that are taught to us is altering in your time. You are the last people who will be able to remember how it was before. And therefore, you are the first people who determine what it is. And that's why my friend Dan Gere is right when he says that this is the last generation in which the human race gets a choice. All right, more questions, objections? Yes.
Yeah, I guess.
I was just looking at the first thing around.
Are there any studies of how the human attention span was affected by the invention of radio and television? Because
not in the same way that we now have information about this. Not like the article I was describing in the talk in Berlin with which we started this course. We don't have that kind of big data reasoning about it. We have some qualitative reasoning. You want to look, for example, at Susan Slonian's wonderful history of early commercial radio called Silent Radio. But we don't possess an easy guide unless you want to talk about how many people read Dickens novels. In other words, if you want to think about people's reading and communications habits in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, you could get some data. And if you want to think about reading lists in higher education, you could get some data. But you understand that it's elite data, and it's narrow. And if you really wanted to measure the human attention span, you wouldn't want to do it on elite data, which was narrow. You'd like to do it broadly, the way the editors of that piece in Nature were doing it. Everything from movie ticket sales to the weight and length of books being sold, and et cetera, et cetera. And for that, we don't have what it would take to offer apples to apples comparison. Of course, that doesn't make history impossible. History is always possible on the basis of the integrity of whatever limited documentary evidence you have. So this is a subject you can write a history of the human attention span, 1900 to 2020. It's a feasible book, but it won't be quite as tractable as that. Is that responsive?
Yeah, I just wonder because it seems that when people started getting more time on their hands after the Industrial Revolution, they found ways to waste more time, too. So I wonder how much it is.
Maybe that's right, or maybe people help them to waste more time. I take it your immediate intuitive response is workers didn't use the time they gained back to educate themselves. Okay? Another way of thinking about it, which is a premise of E.P. Thompson's Rise of the English Working Class, is that capitalism figured out ways to deceive them. That's the premise underlying both the Communist Manifesto that I stole and the communist manifesto that I made out of. The capitalism didn't want its workers to learn a hell of a lot and still doesn't, and basically gives them both ways to waste their time and feelings of wanting to waste their time. So I'm not convinced that that was the consequence of people deciding to waste, but I agree with you that what it was not was every brain on earth learning everything it wanted everywhere all the time without regard to ability to pay. On the other hand, those societies which took whatever step they took in the direction of universal education overwhelmingly triumphed over the course of lifetimes by doing so. Scotland became a country with a universal education system by accident. In 1691, the Scots Presbyterians were trying to figure out how to do better religious persecution. They wanted to make sure everybody grew up to be Presbyterian. And so they enacted a law that said that every community of over 60 families must have a statutable schoolmaster. The Puritans in New England had basically came by a similar road to a belief in universal education. But the United States became the first country in the world to have true universal primary and secondary education. Yeah, very good effect. Both in Scotland and in the United States. And there can be no person here who does not understand what it means when Taliban say female persons will not go to secondary school anymore in our country. I do want you to contemplate that just for a moment. That is an example of a genocidal attack on the freedom to think, to learn, to understand. It's genocidal, even if it's only addressed to roughly 50% of the population. It's a femicidal attack. There's no doubt about that. But remember that those of us who have been fighting for 1,000 years for freedom of thought, we know very well what the alternative is, and so do you. It's in front of your faces. To a first approximation, in my personal view, there are two things lawyers should do in the next generation. They should work on saving the planet from human behavior, and they should work on saving human behavior from the parasite of the world of God. There are other things that it's good for lawyers to work on, although I am dubious that buying and selling companies is one of them. But to a first approximation, those are the two great things. This course is only about one of those problems. But I do want to say that it's about one of those problems, all the way, soup to nuts. And it begins from this. How do we secure the human beings' freedom to think and learn? Each human being's freedom to think and learn. In my terribly left-wing way of thinking about the world, freedom is just privilege extended, unless it is enjoyed by one and all. Freedom of thought is not for intellectuals. The whole of the human race depends in what it is, not what it does, not what it feels, but what it is, on the decisions about the nature of the human thought process and the rights of the human being to it, which are at the periphery of almost everybody else's thinking. But which, as far as I am concerned, are one central core of one of the two problems that people learning to be lawyers in this world right now are into. That's my submission. Okay? Right or wrong, that's what I believe. More questions? Yes?
A few things you said about freedom of thought make me feel like I don't have a very working understanding of what it is. For example, we were talking about, a few weeks ago, I asked about privacy and whether it was necessary for freedom of thought. You said it is. But I can't think of anybody, I guess maybe it's not sufficient for freedom of thought, which is understandable, but like, you were saying that...
Right, you asked me whether it was a necessary condition, and I said yes.
But you were saying before that freedom of thought is something that was really only like invented 500 years ago. But I think about everything you were talking about, privacy, and like all of these outputs that are a threat to freedom of thought. sorry, not in trouble, just saying what I'm trying to say.
No, when, I think you know. I see no trouble yet. Okay. That makes sense to me.
Wouldn't the early hominids have had, like, the most freedom of thought? Like, the...
Well, this is a good question, okay? The most freedom of thought. So we need to multiply two quantities to get a product called amount of freedom of thought. One of which is time and ability to think, and the other is things to think about. No, they didn't have as many things to think about. We touched briefly on the nature of the universe in this conversation, discussing persons like Einstein and Heisenberg. And they were not Homo erectus. They needed quite a lot of math and quite a lot of the history of civilization in order to get to the point where they can think that. My friends Marx and Engels, from whom I steal too, they also, they are all of them, as Isaac Newton said, they're standing on the shoulders of giants. And of course, he wasn't the first person to say that either. So yes, they couldn't see very far because they weren't standing on the shoulders of giants, but you're right, they were free. Maybe we should call that free. And then we would have to ask, who do we mean was free? Because of course, the oldest and most comprehensive injustice in the history of humanity is what happens to female persons. And they were not free. The human race is much more like our chimp cousins. It's violent misogynists than it is like Bono. Although we have the capacity to be as matriarchal as Bono, we are very flexible, us human beings. But if you want to ask who has freedom of thought, and you get all warm and weepy about Aristotle and Plato and such, one just has to remember there's also slaves, like the boy who turns out to know a lot of mathematics because Socrates knows how to question him. And all those women who will never show up in any of those places, they're less even than slaves. Right? And yeah, were they free? Well, they were, and no, they weren't. And okay, I mean, returning the women of Afghanistan to a prehistoric condition doesn't free them to think, right? I mean, yeah, it's true. They have to stay inside and look after babies, and some people who stay inside and look after babies can think freely. Though the epidemic has just reminded us that really works. But no, we have been making progress over all these years. Right? It isn't that we haven't achieved more ability to have freedom of thought, it's that we flinch from it. Because equal freedom of thought equalizes power relationships that it is not in the interest of power to equalize. Yes, I do actually believe and will later on be trying in an intellectually responsible fashion to defend the proposition that copyright increases ignorance. Right? That's, for me, fundamental. That's why I don't like it. But the important point isn't that copyright increases ignorance. The important point is that power likes ignorance. And until we come to grips with the fact that power likes ignorance, we can't really understand why it is that my comrades in the movement for freedom of thought have done so much dying over the last thousand. The real enemy in this isn't human progress. So the technology is wonderful. I love it very much. I've spent my life living inside it. I'm very fond of computers. The problem wasn't the computers. The problem was and remains people. Okay, more about this, or maybe I go back to the net. Just, fine. So let me do that for a little while. I have said that what we are best to do is to understand the thing we call the internet, not as a thing, and not as a space, but as a sociological condition, an alteration in the way human sociality works, that is pervasive, girdles the globe. Whether you are exchanging something with a person in Saigon, or a person in Singapore, or a person in Dushanbe, doesn't matter. Whether it is from Manhattan to Brooklyn or it is from the moon is the same. And its pervasiveness means it's always there. And when we say always there, then we need to define what we mean by that. by asking, how does this nervous system work? Like your sympathetic nervous system or like your CNS? Your net pushes you way more than my net is allowed to push me. My net is a lot more about pull than your net is. Notwithstanding the fact that you have infinite capacity to pull. You can always address a search engine or a website, or you can go and say, I want this. Will somebody give it to me? And yet, a great deal of your net is it pushing you and you responding to it. And that feels completely normal to you. And it feels completely abnormal to me. Let's not worry now about the shape of the long day. Let's worry now about 8 minutes. Now, the 8 minutes that follow a class. A class ends, and two different things go on in your mind and in mine. And by yours, I don't mean every single person. I'm not characterizing. I'm merely talking about what statistically happens. The minute class ends, something interrupts you and you respond to it. Or you get on the phone, or more likely send a text message to somebody, thus interrupting yourself. I can't even imagine responding that way to a class. It was impossible to respond that way to classes when I was taking them. It would never have occurred to me to make or return a telephone call within 30 minutes of the end of any class I took when I was an undergraduate. You can't even begin to imagine it. But then, of course, I lived in a dorm room for years with no telephone. We didn't have phones. Phones! Never mind all the other stuff. For me, the time after a class ends is absolutely neuropsychologically necessary for thinking about the class. When I sat in it, that's all I did. I walked out the door and I thought about it. Now, after a third of a century of teaching it, that's still true. I don't schedule a call in my professional life within 30 minutes of the end of a class. Yesterday, there was a general counsel, an ex-general counsel, of a Fortune 500 company. He rang me 5 times between the middle of my Tuesday class and the period at 6 p.m., an hour and a half after my Tuesday class. And of course he couldn't get me. To me, that's just standard operating procedure. After class ended, I spent time talking to students. I walked home through Riverside Park. I was thinking about what we had been doing. Of course I'm not going to take a fucking call. But the minute that class ended yesterday afternoon, one student immediately was in the phone, and I said to her, I hope that I didn't make you uncomfortable. Oh no, she said, I was just answering a text message. And I thought to myself, of course, because a text message arrived, you had to answer. To me, the extent to which the net pushes at you makes you respond to it rather than it responding to a request from you is a fundamental characteristic of the neurology. You have a reflex, as the neurologists would say, right? The net carries it on with a little rubber hammer and it hits you and you jump, right? Okay, I get it. That's perfectly understandable. But it's pathological. It's not the way to hook up the interspecies, the intraspecies nervous system. There should be less pushing in your world. Oh, but that's hopeless. The devices that you use are optimized for pushing at you. The smart-ass phone is a spy satellite with buzz and wrinkle in it, right? Its job is pushing you. Swipe now. And even the way your computers work is too much like that. But that's okay, because having a disrupted attention system is now species normal. A change in how the human attention system works is normalized. You've been living that way so long that the other way, may not even feel possible to you, let alone good. My devices, the software, the physiology of the interlinkage between me and the net is based on one thing. When I want you to leave me the fuck alone, you leave me the fuck alone. Because I have a use for being alone. But the current most common way of interconnecting to other people is to grant to the neural material in between the power to interrupt you under almost all circumstances. Why is your phone turned off? Shit. Why is my phone lying disabled without a battery in it on the counter in my apartment? That's not allowed. I mean, it's not allowed. You can't take the battery out of these things. The hardware doesn't even want you to control the electrical flow in the device. You think there's an off button. Imagine that. I don't mean contemplate. I mean, imagine that. Imagine that you live in a form of the human race in which the idea that you carry around the thing you can't electrically disable, and you feel an inner compulsion to respond to every beep and buzz and vibrate. Imagine what that would feel like if that wasn't your life. And then you can begin to imagine what it feels like to me. Because it isn't my life. It could never become my life. I wouldn't allow that to happen to me. But I'm old and arcane and not part of this culture, and as they would say if they had to give a reason for offing me, he knows too much. That is to say, I don't allow technology to define for me how I work, because I've spent my whole life making this stuff and I'm going to have to do what I want. That's what it means to have a personal computer revolution. We define. But as you are well aware, that's not how persuasive design works. That's not how user experience is currently embodied in the objects. User experience is a standard definition. It's a terribly bad idea ever to try to use a computer because it won't work. You won't know what's going on. It won't look the same. It won't feel the same. It won't sound the same because it's mine. But if I steal one of your computers, I can know what to do with it immediately, because I work the same way. How could it be? Well, because you've been raised to be users. Or used, or whatever you want to call it. But the expectations of the relationship between you and the nervous system are set by the nervous system. Very convenient if you want to be a society that denies the existence of democracy and human freedom, et cetera, et cetera. Then it's great. Not so good if you want to have that, but you're undermining the values, technologically speaking. So this is the net. A change in the nature of human interaction. Epical in character. Fundamentally altering how human beings teach one another, and therefore, excuse me for getting grandiose about it, fundamentally defining the purpose of human thought and what it means to be human. And conducted in a particular contingent way. Not a way that the technology has to work, but the way it does work. That's the net. When we grasp it, when we physically have our hand around it, we're touching the beating heart of what is happening to the changing definition of what it means to be human. And you live at the most tumultuous time in that process. Whereas you notice, forms of public discourse and deliberation are failing in new ways. Not that they didn't have old ways to fail, but that the new modes of failure are different. In my work, I call this the nausea accompanying metamorphosis, because that's really what's going on. We're changing. And it's uncomfortable. The fly is trying to burst out from, well, you know, I mean, I don't need to explain. We have lots of science fiction about this. science fiction is doing what imaginative fiction is supposed to do. It's telling us about our own condition by exoticizing. The science fiction of our childhoods, the childhoods of people of my generation, were all about nuclear war. They were all about the unintended consequences of technology. Which is why those of us who read it and worked on it grew up to be mostly concerned about the unintended consequences of the technology we were helping to create. That's how we were made, me and my comrades. That's where it came from. Your imaginative literature is about the nausea accompanying metamorphosis. And you can begin to feel it deeply because you can feel all the social stress that is resulting from that. The metamorphosis of the planet and the metamorphosis of the human mind. The feeling of out-of-controlness that results from powers too big even to grasp, let alone to deal with. But we could learn something. We could learn something powerful and important. We could try and use the knowledge of the waypoints, navigation, the history, to fight the nausea. We could stabilize our view, and then we'll get less airsick as we change. All right, so that's what the net as an idea is. Questions? Yeah?
I guess in terms of the net changing us as opposed to societal expectations is sort of what I'm troubled by. The push notifications, it's not necessarily the way the network is set up to me, it's that people are sending us push notifications. And as we become more available with cell phones, like employers have different expectations.
Employers. You're going to be lawyers and you want to talk to me about employers. That already tells me why on the other side of my job, I spend my time trying to help people have law practices instead of jobs. If you're right, let's assume you're right, then that's already an alarm bell ringing very loudly in my mind. Lawyers are growing up to worry about the expectations of employers. We are in deep shit with respect to the rule of law, right? Isn't that the conclusion that we're following? I know. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have interrupted. Now let's return to regularly scheduled dealing with evidence madness. But remember on the other side that I lodged an objection. You're right. Employer pressure is a thing that affects law students. My God. You are the most privileged people on earth with respect to that. And still you're right. It's true. So, now let's go back to where you were. Let's try and tease out the difference between the expectations and the functioning of technology, which is, I think, what you're really trying to get at. Good. So let's use an analytical problem on that. Learning in law school under Zoom, okay? A subject about which everybody in this room is aware. Right? Perhaps you did and perhaps you didn't, because we're not in virtual instruction now. But maybe you read the article in my wiki called Why Not Video Conference, which is the thing I wrote at the beginning of the epidemic about why my system of virtual instruction doesn't use video conferencing for instruction, okay? But let's not worry right now about what I think. Let's worry about what you think. Did the expectations of the people who built Zoom School really determine whether Zoom School worked for you as learning?
You may have to ask someone else. I actually didn't use Zoom School.
Because you weren't here last year, because you were somewhere else in the world doing other things.
Correct.
Okay, good. So those who have been beneficiaries, not to say victims of Zoom School, did you have the feeling that the people who designed it got what they wanted or not? No, I mean, I don't know, but for me, it was obvious ahead of time that Zoom School would be a complete failure. Teaching some things by video conferencing is possible. Teaching law school by video conferencing is not possible. So I said at the beginning of the epidemic, look, here are going to be the problems, why I won't use video conferencing. Okay? It coerces attention in the long way. You have to stay all day long looking like you're paying attention to something. Okay? And that's bad physically and neurologically, it's completely incorrect. What you need to do is to activate people's imaginations, because they're all not commonly in a place experiencing a theatrical, a moment of togetherness. They're all in little telephone booths. And what you need is for their minds to be activated on the side of imagination. And if you take my first year of law school course, then, which you couldn't do either, then we have the second law of social psychology for lawyers, which is humanoid primates believe what they see and imagine what they hear. And we could go back to the first era and think about that a little bit. Primates are visual animals who specialize in life, I mean hominid primates, are visual animals who specialize in life during the daytime. They believe what they see because their eyes are the primary sense. But human beings have been trying to stay alive in the dark for 5 million years, and we imagine what we hear. Human beings imaginatively reconstruct what happens in the dark because they can't see. They can't depend upon their primary sense, and so they have to build an internal reconstruction. And every twig break and every fall of a fruit and every step in the dark has to be fit into an imaginary conception. The great radio producer, Tony Schwartz, who pretty much single-handedly turned the United States into a non-smoking society, because from the moment of the Surgeon General's report in 1964, Tony started making anti-smoking public service announcements for American radio. And more than anybody else, he was responsible for the vast alteration in the nature of the collective consciousness about the dangers of smoking. Tony said, "The reason radio is powerful is that people are born without ear lids." And I learned that from him when I was a child, and he was bloody correct. It's the source of the second law of social psychology for lawyers. So, video conference teaching in law school during the epidemic fails because it shows you pictures that you believe, but they're useless pictures. In fact, they're worse than useless. And it does not make imagination happen. Radio does that. Which is why in my form of virtual instructions, I am in a podcast. And then we meet by text in a chat room. And nobody does Zoom school, and it works way better. But I said all of that at the beginning of the epidemic, and I was, from a technical point of view, pulling it out of my rear end, right? But you can go and look at the Stanford Psychology publication from the end of the year about why video conferencing is bad for teaching, and they discovered by survey and analysis of the survey data all the things that I said about video conference teaching at the beginning. The expectations, I'm trying to say, weren't what determined the outcome. The technology, in its relation to the fixed nature of human neuropsychology, determined the outcome. And you're lucky you missed it. You are. We charge full price for that. One thing I learned from watching my own students go through Zoom school last year is a dog that didn't bark in the nighttime. After more than 3 decades of teaching law school, last year was the only year in my career in which a student never said to me, "But Professor so-and-so said this in class." I am accustomed all the time to indirect dialogue with other teachers about things. As students listen to X, and they listen to me, and they say, "Evan is crazy, but X is dull," but there's discussion. Never in all of my teaching life had it happen that all other teachers seem to be invisible in the interaction between me and my students. Why? Because it went in one ear and out the other. They had anxiety about exams, they learned this, they didn't learn that, they had questions, but none of it related to the imagined world of ideas between themselves and the teachers. None. It was the zero which was so interesting. Absolute absence of any such information was in itself extremely informative. Zoom school was failing because teachers weren't connecting with students. Well, that's kind of obvious. But they expected to. Teachers liked Zoom school. It made them feel almost normal. It was the least change possible. So everybody did it. This is what I would say about the other technologies in the large. You understand why I have to belabor this poor illustration. I don't think that the problem is the expectations, though we do have to go back to the question of does ignorance serve social purposes? Is the crappy bandwidth that you have and the crappy hardware that you have and the crappy software that you have useful to some people? And the answer is yes. Hence the piece I put on the on the radar this week about what Facebook is up to and using its news feed to make itself look cleaner. Right? Did they expect Instagram to cause a whole lot of body shaming and terrible insecurity among the world's young people? No, they didn't expect it. Do they know that it happened? Yes, they do. Are they hiding it? Yes, they're hiding it. Does that in itself become an expectation? Yes, in a way, sure. But it would have been easier just to think about the technology in relation to the human psychology at the outset. And that's not what they're doing. Because their purpose in thinking about human psychology isn't to ask our people healthy. It's to ask our people engaged. The parasite of the mind of God doesn't care whether you have a bad body. It doesn't care whether you're feeling insecure. It cares whether you're clicking and swiping. In that sense, they meet my expectations rather than their own. Is that responsive, or do you want to follow up to do this in what for you is a better way?
I'd say that that is fairly responsive, but it has the follow-up, I guess, of that's still Facebook measuring your engagement, not so much the internet, but it's...
Exactly. Because the internet isn't a thing. There's only services. Now this is the last point I wanted to make, and you're helping me to make it. If we ask what is going on in this condition of universal interconnection, the answer is services. We can think about the net as a collection of services. That's actually the way the TCP/IP layer of networking works. From a software point of view, this and most of the other phenomena that we investigate can be thought of best if you have in mind an onion with multiple layers. The technologies that we use are like that. They are built as layers upon layers of structures made by software. And at every layer, we can understand what is going on at that layer as though it were independent of the others. In order to have a network, we use essentially two components to build this nervous system. You can think of them as though there were two kinds of cells. Pipes and switches. I am using old 20th century flowchart-like symbols to denote these things. These lines are pipes, and these diamonds are switches, the two kinds of cells that exist in a network. A pipe is a cell that moves messages from point A to point B and back again. The only job of the pipe is transport. It changes no signals, and it makes no decisions. In the world of the anatomy we're talking about, a pipe could be a copper wire, it could be a glass fiber thinner than a human hair, or it could be a string tying together two tin cans. The software protocols that we use don't care what pipes are made of. They depend only upon the physical prominence, the physical property of a pipe, that it moves signals from A to B and B to A without changing them or making any decisions. Switches, on the other hand, are deciding points. A switch determines which signals move in which pipes, towards whom, on what terms, with what permissions or anti-permissions, prohibitions, what costs, what other associated structures. The switch is what contains the intelligence of the network distributed through all the different switches. For our purposes, every general purpose computer is a switch. Earlier networks were built with many different kinds of switching gear, many different kinds, electromechanical things, moving magnets and conductors around, it doesn't matter. Once again, the net doesn't really care how, the design, the anatomy of the net, doesn't really care whether all switches are precisely anatomically the same. They pursue the same function. So we have a net built of pipes and switches. It's a little complicated because we use the word switch to talk about some kinds of hardware, and never mind that. For the moment, it doesn't matter. What I want to point out about this network of pipes and switches is that the software structures which put that together are known as the Internet Protocol. That's not intellectual property in this class, that's the Internet Protocol. And the Internet Protocol says that every switch in the network has an address made of some numbers. Let's use the simple kind, that's IPv4 addressing, and every switch has an address made of four numbers between 0 and 255. 128.59.177.251 is the actual Internet Protocol address at government.law.columbia.edu. Every time you talk to my web server, at the IP level, what is happening is a bunch of things we call datagrams, tiny little bunches of data, 64 bytes wide, are being exchanged across pipes. One end is here, and the other end is wherever your computer is. Let's call that 192.167.1.1. It's a joke address, but I don't expect you to find it funny. So you're here, and I'm there, and we're sending a bunch of packets back and forth. And the only thing IP knows is how to move a datagram from its source to its destination, given that this datagram includes both of these numbers. Source and destination are encoded, and then there's a payload, and the protocol's job is moving it from here to there. You can think of that as the fundamental layer of the anatomy. The ability to move a signal from one switch to another, given the addresses from which and to which it is going. That won't be enough to run a web server. That'll only get some data back and forth. Now we have to define what that data means and how it works. That's another set of software called the Transmission Control Protocol. We could also talk about another protocol called UDP, but let's be nice and simple. And so we actually refer to the stuff that runs the net as being TCP/IP. That means the layer at the bottom that moves datagrams around from source to destination, and the structures which say, what is this transmission control about? Right? For these purposes, every switch has a maximum of 65,535 different services it can offer. They're called ports. So on this particular switch, which let us say is 128.59.177.251, it offers some services to people. That means under the transmission control protocol, some other computer in the net can say, hi, mobile.law.columbia.edu. Have you got a web server there? Yes, I have a web server there. That's described as I am trying to connect to port 80 on your computer, because port 80 is where the web server is. Or if it's HTTPS, it's at 443, because encrypted web service is a different service. Hi, mobile.law.columbia.edu. Do you have a web server at port 80? Yes, I have a web server at port 80. Okay, I'm going to talk to you. Yes, I'm going to let you talk to me. here, I gave you something. Did you get it? Yes, I got that. Here's another thing. Did you get that? Yes, I got that. Now, if you decide to go and get a few dozen megabytes of audio or video off my web server, they're going to do that a lot of times. Did you get that? Yes, I got that. Did you get this? Yes, I got that. Did you get this? Yes, I got that. And that's important because each one of those little pieces in which that audio or video was broken up is only guaranteed to get to you. It's not guaranteed to get to you in order. It's not always guaranteed to get to you. It can get lost. And so the TCP has to keep saying, the TCP protocol between the two computers has to keep saying, are you receiving what I'm sending you? Yes, I'm receiving what I send you. Do you need anything resent? No, I don't need anything resent. Did you get it out of order? Yes, I got it out of order. Okay, tough luck. That's your responsibility. I don't guarantee you that you get all the pieces of the puzzle in order. You have to put it together yourself. All that conversation is going on underneath. It's the chatter of the computers with one another that you don't feel, because all you know is, I wanted a service. The service is, I have a URL, give me the data that's relevant, index.html or lis-2021-, et cetera, et cetera. All right? So in this world, all this underlying stuff is meant to make it possible for computers to perform services. You're accustomed to services. Email, calendar, sharing of photographs or other information. The net is, from that point of view, made of services. And services exist in a market. And markets are about the political economy of information. Okay, yes, I know everybody has to go. So do I. That was the last part of today's class. See you in a week.